You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world, and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
And good morning. It's the Green Left Radio Show on 3CR Community Radio, 8:55 a.m. and it's now 7:01 p.m. So with me in the studio, I'm Stephanie, and we've also got Mary and Jacob.
And just before we start, we begin this morning on September the 26th by acknowledging that 3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, the original rightful sovereign owners, storytellers and caretakers of this land. Australia was founded on the attempted genocide and dispossession of the First People, and we recognise that this attempted genocide is still ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all the First Peoples in their struggle for justice and the right to their land.
Okay, so good morning, everyone. You're joined today by myself, Jacob Antwaffa, as one of the other co-presenters. To give you a rundown of what we have coming up on the program, we'll probably play a pre-recorded interview, maybe not the whole interview. You might have to go to the Green Left website to listen to the rest of the interview. But we have an interview with Sin Hong, who is a socialist activist from the United States, who just recently came back from visiting Australia in September for the Eco-Socialism 2025 conference. So he's going to be talking about the kind of experiences of building socialist politics in the United States. Then we're going to be having an interview with a regular guest on 3CR, an interview with Federica Fuentes, who is a regular Green Left writer on Latin America and a longtime Latin American solidarity activist. So we're going to be having a discussion with him about some of the latest developments in the United States, especially with the massive amount of military buildup in the Caribbean Sea, which has actually targeted, Venezuela with, you know, three people who have died as a result of bombings from US warships. And so we'll be having a discussion with him a bit later today. And then we're going to be also talking, then we'll be also having some news discussion about different kind of headline sort of news stories. And in fact, the first news story I guess I want to kind of start off with is probably one of the more exciting kind of news stories. But on September 22nd, approximately 1 million people across Italy staged a general strike in support of Palestine and the global cement flotilla. And this is very much offering, as kind of reported in the People's Dispatch, this is very much offering a vision of solidarity sharply at odds with the ones displayed by the European leaders at the United Nations. And in fact, ports, train stations and major junctions were shut down as workers, many of whom were members of the grassroots union Unione Sindacale di Base USB, brought the country to a halt. And in fact, in Rome alone, probably up to 300,000 demonstrators occupied the city's main railway hub before marching through the streets. The call came from Genoa's dock workers, and here we are, we've blocked everything, the protesters proclaimed. Among those leading the crowd were firefighter union representatives, And, you know, they told, they said at the protest, first responders will never be complicit in genocide. And we are protesting a government that is entrapping us in rearmament. So, yeah, did Steph and Mary want to add anything to kind of this news report?
Well, just like, I was just going to say, power to the Italians. Oh, my goodness. Do they know how to resist or what? It's just incredible that they've all, so many people participated in this general strike. And, yeah, it was schools and teachers. It was, yeah, just across the country, masses of people taking to the streets. And, of course, this occurs in a context, too, where I think at this point, Italy still doesn't recognise the Palestinian state. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I'm going off here. But also, just in the past week, we've also had the UK and Australia and Canada and I think France as well, officially recognising Palestine. Mind you, with Australia in particular, and I'm sure probably some of those other countries, there's so many conditions attached to that recognition that it's just, well, very infuriating for us on the left, I think, because, yeah. And then reading Anthony Albanese's comments about, in response to the recognition, it was all about Hamas and, you know, and the hostages, never mind the, you know, tens of thousands of people that have been killed during the genocide.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think also it's important to mention that this general strike was also supporting, as you said earlier, Jacob, the global Samud flotilla. Mm. So there's about 50 small boats that are attempting to reach Gaza with all sorts of aid. And the Israelis have offered to, after attacking them, have offered to allow them to unload the things that they're carrying, and that they would then deliver them. And the people on the flotilla, yes, that's been their reaction, and they've said, we don't trust Israel to deliver this.
No.
So no, we want to deliver this, and they're continuing, and they're being accompanied by warships from Spain and what's the other country? Does anyone remember? There's two countries that are that have sent warships.
Italy have dispatched a naval vessel, is my understanding.
And I think Spain is one of them as well. Spain
That's what I said.
Mary said Spain.
Yeah. Italy. And I think there's demands being put on France around, and of course, I think Australia's also. But I mean, to put something actually a bit into context as well, I mean, one significant thing about what's happening in Italy is, Italy's actually run by quite a far-right sort of government. And in fact, actually, even though the government has been very pro-Israel, the statements they've actually made around Palestine have actually been in some sense stronger than the Australian government, which kind of says everything. And you kind of see this in the report in the People's Dispatch, where the Prime Minister of Italy makes a comment about how, kind of like along the lines of, you know, it's very hard to support Israel these days.
The foreign minister of Italy was celebrated by the Israelis. He has spoken out in support. So
But what I'm just saying is the fact that the Italian prime minister is sort of can't even make a sort of completely pro-Israel sort of statement. It has to say, oh, it's hard to support Israel these days. I mean, we're still committed to them as friends. I mean, you wouldn't be surprised coming from a far-right sort of government. But it's like what it sort of shows is it shows the kind of impact that the big mass movement for Palestine is having on shifting these sort of government's positions to the point where governments don't even feel confident about giving the full pro-genocide sort of position.
On the other hand, if you're a right-wing government, an ultra-right-wing government like Meloni's is in Italy, you must sort of be conflicted because you wouldn't want, you know, I'm sure there's strong anti-Semitic elements within your ranks. And as Meloni, you might even have your own anti-Semitic feelings. So I'm sure that they're conflicted about which way to go on this issue because... Yeah. Because, they're racist, they're anti-Semitic, etc.
Yeah.
And just to add further to kind of finish off this discussion, so one positive thing is the momentum by the strike is going to be set to continue. So there's actually going to be Italian dock workers are actually going to be hosting international sectorial meeting actually today, or probably today or the next 2 days, where they'll be bringing together trade unions capable of disrupting Europe's arms flows to Israel. And then there's also going to be national demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine, also planned for October 4th as the eyes remain fixed on the global Samud flotilla. And I think, you know, it's showing that even though Israel's sort of showing a willingness to stop the global flotilla, workers are being prepared to kind of strike back. So I think, yeah, all the solidarity to the workers. And it makes me like wish that we had something similar happening in so-called Australia.
Absolutely. Actually, if it's okay, before we move on to the next thing, because it's related, I just thought, given, I mean, the other really significant happening, which we might sort of touch on later, is that Anthony Albanese obviously went to meet with Donald Trump and basically got ditched. It was pretty funny.
But. Yeah. That's good.
He did happen to take a selfie with Donald Trump, which, to be honest, I kind of didn't really understand
why you would do that.
I was a fanboy, maybe.
Maybe to stop, what's his name? Is it Andrew Hastie?
Oh, yeah.
And others from the right wing of the Liberal Party saying, oh, you need to meet with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just on the 4th of October, there's another thing that's happening on the 4th of October, and that's very close to where we all are, which is Eltham. There will be a rally in Eltham from 11:30 a.m. meeting at the town square in Eltham, which is just off Arthur Street. We've got some really strong speakers, including Dr. Bushra Othman, who has been to Gaza a couple of times at least to work there in the hospitals. And there'll be other speakers as well. And we'll be marching down the main street. So please come and join us from 11:30 on the 4th of October.
That's exciting for Eltham. Actually, before we move on as well, I do have exactly what Anthony Albanese was saying about it's gross, it's infuriating. I apologise, listeners, but this is what he had to say when the announcement was made around Palestine being recognised as a state. So he said, this is Albanese, enough is enough. We must end the cycle of violence. Okay. And then goes on, the terrorist atrocities that occurred by Hamas on 7th of October ensure and underline why Hamas can play no role in the future Palestinian state. But just as the Jewish people have a homeland in Israel, Palestinians have a legitimate aspiration for their own homeland as well.
Yeah, their aspiration for a homeland that only makes like less than how much of the landmass that that Israel currently occupies.
anyway, yeah.
All right, so we'll just go play a quick announcement and then we might move on to playing the first part of the interview that we mentioned that we'll play. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. So I'm going to be playing an interview that is part of the Green Left show. Which you can find online on the Green Left website, Green Left Show 67, Fighting for Socialism in the United States. And this is an interview that that is with Sin Hong, who is a socialist activist from the United States who visited Australia in September for the Eco-Socialism 2025 conference. Hun joins the Green Left Show to discuss the process of building the socialist movement in the US, the relationship between the Democratic Socialists of America and the US Democratic Party, and the links between the DSA and figures like Zoran Mamdani and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Hope listeners enjoy. This is is actually quite a very interesting and very informative interview. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.
G'day, my name's Alex Bainbridge. Welcome to the Green F Show. Today I'm here with Sin Hoang, who is a Labor and student activist from the United States. He's a member of the Bread and Roses Caucus in the Democratic Socialists of America. The DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, and Sin has got a lot of interesting stories to tell about the complicated and difficult process of building a socialist movement in the belly of the beast, in the context of the authoritarian far-right administration of Donald Trump. Before we get underway, I do want to acknowledge that we're recording this show on stolen First Nations land. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was, always will be Aboriginal land, and we pledge our solidarity with ongoing struggles for justice. Also, if you like the work that we do, please do become a Green Left supporter if you're not already. Plans start from just $5 a month, and it is the number one way to both support our work and also to receive the content that we produce. I know I say this every episode of the Green Left Show, but please, if you're not already a supporter, please do think about becoming a supporter today. Now, the United States is the largest and most militarily powerful imperialist country on the planet. What happens there affects all of us, no matter where in the world we live. And right now, especially with the far-right Donald Trump administration in power, a lot of basic democratic rights are being wound back, not to mention policies, government apparatus that helps protect ordinary people's living standards, climate, and a lot of other things besides. Now, we can see from experience that the US Democrats, the mainstream capitalism, like the Joe Bidens and the Kamala Harrises of the world, they have simply paved the way for this sort of Trump far-right authoritarianism. If we actually want to see a basic defense of even simple liberal democratic values, basic defense of people's living standards, basic defense of free speech, lack of deportations, etc., we can't rely on the mainstream Democrats to save us. And that's why it's critically important to pay attention to what's happening on the US left. And I began by asking Sin to talk about the Democratic Socialists of America, where things are up to, and more about the process of building a socialist challenge to Donald Trump in that country.
So I just would like to begin first by thanking Socialist Alliance and Green Left for the invitation to the convention, but also being really proactive about starting this ongoing exchange between the Australian left and the US left. It's an exchange that we're learning a lot from, an absolute strategic necessity to confront the far right, which has made some very violent escalations. I mean, these past couple months, but especially these past few weeks in Australia, we saw the March for Australia, a very xenophobic, racist, nationalist project here, take to the streets with a huge Nazi contingent across the world. We've seen the extrajudicial killings of Venezuelans in international waters, extreme barbarity in Gaza. There are too many things to name this past week. Things are really accelerating. So the need for an independent left-wing alternative is clear, has been clear for a while, now more than ever, especially in the face of the collapse of the neoliberal center, which has, you know, helped administer the most brutal austerity to the international working class for decades. And so you're right that our hopes rest on an independent alternative left that's, you know, founded on grassroots mobilization and working class democracy. To that extent, DSA is one of the most important developments that has taken place in the context of the U.S. left. And it's a development that speaks to a broader revitalization of the United States left, which is a huge strategic necessity if you want to bring down capitalism in the 21st century. So DSA, a couple weeks ago, between August 8th and 10th, just had its national convention involving 1,300 delegates from across the country, 300 more volunteers, international guests, observers, activists who were there just contributing to the dynamism of the event. It reflects an important moment of DSA's growth. We're not decisive in national or international politics yet. I wish we were, but we are increasingly influential in a lot of different meaningful processes. What's making us hopeful, not just in the U.S., but around the world, is the election of a young progressive Muslim immigrant from Uganda. His name is Zuran Mamdani. He's poised to become the mayor of New York City, championing a real working class program and building a campaign founded on grassroots mobilization from many diverse sectors, from labor unions to the pro-Palestine movement. DSA was a huge force behind it, so DSA members are involved in that, as well as a movement within unions to reform them, to become more democratic, solidaristic, and militant. Our members played some crucial roles in some reform battles in, for example, the UAW, which is the most powerful, historic, and experienced union in the U.S. context. Campaign across the country for Palestine, for public renewables, on the issues that matter to working people. And so, although we're not decisive, it is a growing political force in U.S. society. And just to give you a little bit of, a more schematized history of the U.S. left, I mean, the current iteration of the U.S. left really only started 10 years ago off the backs of the elections of Bernie Sanders and people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It was really very much the political wilderness before, when it was just a scattershot, small groupings of very closed kind of line organizations on the left. And then off of these mass processes, not just insurgent electoral campaigns, but mass strikes by educators and healthcare workers in, the mid to late 2010s, it created a huge space in society for new activists who, were curious about democratic socialism to assert themselves and create spaces of their own, especially the Democratic Socialists of America. So today we've grown to about 80,000 members. We have activists working across a variety of sectors, like I mentioned before, and we've gone through a lot of learning these past 10 years. We started with the highest of highs, thinking that Bernie might win the Democratic primary race, and then we went through a really tough period, especially with COVID, but also the collapse of the broader projects represented by Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, Syriza, Podemos. It was a really hard moment, especially for a burgeoning Marxist left around the world to figure out what a new program for this moment could be. And so, we didn't have tradition, history, a lot of activists to go on. We had to make history ourselves, and coming out on the other side of it, it's very precious that we have an organization that's still fighting and growing against all odds. So, I started to ramble, but hopefully there's something in there that answers your question.
That's okay. That's great. But I tell you what, I wanted to nail down in particular about the question of the relationship between the DSA and the Democratic Party. I mean, sure. The Democratic Party is obviously a key institution in U.S. society, and I guess a graveyard for a lot of left-wing movements.
Yeah.
On the other hand, a lot of the left-wing dynamism is coming around primary challenges within the Democratic Party. So, can you talk about that connection between the Democratic Party and the DSA? And I guess related to that, questions of accountability between elected representatives who might be members or endorsed by the DSA and the grassroots activists based of the movement.
Yeah, maybe just to address the broad parameters of the question, oftentimes DSA is confused for the Democratic Party itself. There's no surprise there, given that it's hard for anybody, whether you're watching from another country or in the United States itself, it's very hard to imagine any kind of political space that exists to the left of the Democrats. And also, DSA is known to use the Democratic Party ballot line to contest elections. So it's totally understandable why this conflation exists. But in reality, there is no formal structured relationship between DSA and the Democratic Party. In fact, even actual Democrats, capital D next to their name, it's hard for them to have any structured engagement with the party as well, because there's really no there. It's thoroughly controlled by capitalist interests, the donor class. They decide everything from who runs from president, what the party program is. And, it's clear that working class people don't get to engage with it or control it. I can't walk into a local Democratic Party meeting. Oftentimes those don't even happen. I can't say what I want the Democratic Party to do to, organize workers in my community or advance working class interests. So there's often no there. But in reality, I think, characterizing DSA's relationship to the Democrats is quite difficult. is quite difficult, one, because it's a very fluid thing. And just to give you a little bit of history, I mean, pre-2016, pre-DSA's revitalization, just for context, DSA has existed for many decades, but its current iteration really started in 2016. Prior to that, it was really no question or debate about what our orientation to the Democrats would be, since it was such a much tougher political period with way fewer, you know, class struggle. People just accepted, took it for granted that we would be the quote-unquote left wing of the possible, in the words of Michael Harrington, actually one of our founders, that the only thing we could do is try to reform the Democratic Party in a more progressive direction. And you know, there wasn't any, you know, really much thinking as an alternative to that. Today, however, post, you know, 2016, off the backs of Bernie, there's the discussion in DSA is very plural, and it's evolved in some really important ways. There are, of course, you know, different tendencies or currents within the party who want to very much realign it still to turn the Democrats into a force for working class interest. I'm very skeptical of such a strategy because of the many numerous historical failed attempts at doing so, and also just an analysis of what the party is and who controls it. You know, should the left wing get better organized and be more powerful, it's would not be a surprise at all if the Democratic Party tried to maneuver to kick us out and force us into the political wilderness again. We've seen this at, you know, at more embryonic levels. For example, when DSA members won Democratic Party elections in Nevada, I believe, in the pandemic era, and then immediately the Democratic Party leadership stripped the voter rolls, stripped all the money, all the committees, and, you know, we were stranded. And so, yeah, I'm very skeptical of a strategy of reforming the Democratic Party. And I will say there are many currents now that run through DSA that are advocating for a policy of political independence, working towards a horizon of building an independent party for the working class. This debate has gotten more rich as we've gained more experience running insurgent campaigns, but also building extra-parliamentary struggles that, you know, we believe any working-class party should be rooted in, should support, and champion. And so just to give you a sampling of some of the debates, I mean, within the last 4 years, the past two DSA conventions in 2025 and 2023, the convention, the highest national decision-making body of the organization, affirmed stances for independent political action. We have, you know, a diversity of tactics, you know, advocating for a policy of tactical flexibility as well, trying to run independently where it makes sense, trying to build independent party apparatuses out of community struggle. So not just building parties around candidates, but building parties out of, you know, collective projects of the working class, but also where necessary, contesting the Democratic Party ballot line, because it often gives us a huge audience to talk to and to shape. It's not inevitable that all that energy will be channeled back within to the Democratic Party. I mean, there are really complex questions of how we want to act in these scenarios, especially with Zoran now, you know, being the new face of the Democratic Party in New York City. But here, it's a strategic calculation about what's the best opportunity we have to meet as many people as possible, bring a socialist message, organize people into class struggle. And sometimes that forces us to run on the Democratic Party ballot line, but it's not a scenario that we want to depend on. In fact, the people that we meet through these campaigns, we want to educate them about the class nature of society and what it's going to take to win for the working class. And so, yeah, the past two conventions affirmed these more independent stances. Oftentimes, they're kind of contradictory mandates when it comes to the questions of accountability or coordination. I'm very proud to be part of a tendency that talks a lot about the need to use these electoral projects as launch pads for other kinds of political projects, for more organizing the working class, not just to put, you know, left celebrities in office who often take good stances but are not accountable to a collective project. Now, with the way that DSA works, we're not a democratic centralist line organization. You know, we very rarely, you know, will censor, expel, you know, draw red lines in the sand that way. The way discipline works in DSA is very much self-imposed. It depends on politics and persuasion. And so, in terms of building more accountability for especially our elected bench, what that means is waging the battle of ideas for people who agree that, you know, we need to work towards an independent vehicle of the working class. We need to write more. We need to hold more discussions, convince people that there's no future in the Democrats. And simultaneously, we need to build the broader infrastructure and class struggles that create politicized people that believe that, you know, workers need their own vehicle. And so I think, you know, in these past couple of days, talking to comrades around the world, I've mentioned that Zoran is in some ways a reflection of that long-term bet of creating class struggles that create politicized people. You know, he cut his teeth organizing for Palestine at college. He built a Students for Justice in Palestine chapter. He's more organic to DSA than any other elected official of his stature that we've had. He's participated in the organization since 2017, worked on various insurgent campaigns, not just electoral ones. And to the extent that he's done that, he's had real experiences in collective organization where he's, you know, privy to debates in DSA about the need for an alternative. That creates a certain kind of person that thinks about the political opportunities of his office, and he's not just operating as a lone wolf. So I think that's the big bet that we have as socialists in the DSA, is to create class struggles, to create rich, dynamic organizations that make this a collective principle of ours, that we want our own independent organizations. Mm. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier the DSA convention, and I think there has been some discussion on the left about that. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm wondering if you could talk more about some of the issues that came up there in particular. I guess there was also this resolution about the DSA becoming an anti-Zionist, or describing itself as an anti-Zionist organization.
Yeah.
There was some controversy about that. Can you talk about some of those issues that came up at that convention and some of the discussion that surrounded it?
For sure. And after this, I'll link you to an interview that's definitely more polished about what I can say, than what I'll say now. But just to give you a brief run through, DSA just had its convention in August at a very crucial, you know, critical turning point in the world. It was a very dynamic affair with the biggest ever gathering in our organization's history, and we came out of the weekend debating a lot of important themes and passing a lot of very ambitious resolutions. I think probably the most ambitious set we've ever passed, ranging from, you know, insurgent electoral kind of battles to how to advance the movement for Palestine, how to, you know, further our labor work and bridge the gap that's, you know, been built through over the past couple of decades, a gap between the labor movement and the left. And so just to try to systematize a bit, I would say the three main themes axes of convention debate were around the question of 2028. Another would be around Palestine, as you mentioned. A third would be around organizational internal questions. So just to take the latter first, going into convention, things seemed really hard to parse through, kind of depoliticized, hard to say what the stakes were. I mean, at an objective level, we do know what the stakes are, given the far right, rise of the far right around the world, and the impossible situation the working class is in these days. But in terms of the way that DSA debate itself was playing out, a lot of people were speculating on Twitter that the main debates would be around, like, for example, one member, one vote, reform for how we would elect top leadership. And so going into convention, it was kind of like smoke and mirrors, hard to figure out what the pulse points were. The first day of convention, Friday, was more so dominated by internal questions of organizational reform. I think, a lot of people across all tendencies would have wished we spent more time on the major political questions of the day, debating an explicit strategy for defeating Trump. But just to, I think, credit ourselves a little bit, these organizational debates are not unimportant. They reflect an organization under construction. They're the product of years of just struggling with our internal culture to make DSA more democratic, more efficient, so we can carry out the political priorities that our membership has. And so all the resolutions debated at that block pointed to a desire, again, for more democratic and politicized organizations. We affirm the need for staff to carry out the will of elected leadership and membership. We declared that we wanted to stipend political leaders, as just opposed to like random 9-to-5 NGO workers, to be full-time, you know, battlers for our political priorities, and a suite of other reforms. So that was an important advance that I think, you know, has been a huge sticking point in our organization. Another theme would be 2028. So this is the presidential year, but also the other resonance of it is that the president of the UAW, Sean Fain, has made a call for labor unions to align their contract expiration dates on May 1st, International Workers Day, in 2028, kind of gesturing at a general strike. And so it's very strange, especially for international guests, to hear so much weight assigned to 2028 when things are collapsing in 2025. But that number, that year, has gained some real objective significance precisely because of the call of the International Auto Workers president. And so in the lead up to 2028, but also today, you know, labor unions, community groups, activist organizations are exploring more ways to coordinate, to rehearse up to a bigger action in 2028, but also to face up to the Trump threat today. And so we've seen, you know, coordinated mobilizations, for example, on May Day 2025, labor unions work with community organizations to defend immigrant members, or for example, teachers unions in my local are working together with DSA and all sorts of groups to figure out how to defend their students when they have to go to court hearings to raise money for legal fees, but also to build mobilizations, you know, that can change societal opinion. And so that was a huge inflection of debate. Around 2028, we affirmed some really ambitious things, you know, running probably contesting the 2028 presidential election from the left. Increasingly, I mean, we have some tough questions to parse through, because increasingly it looks like that candidate could be AOC, who's taken some indefensible votes, especially around Iron Dome funding. But in addition to the presidential race, we affirmed that we want to run five congressional level candidates, hopefully with DSA members or people, you know, who are believers in a kind of collective strategy and a project. With respect to the labor movement, you know, DSA has pretty robust work there, ranging from labor solidarity to major strikes to political education for our own members. We have a salting program that gets our own members, you know, to be members of the labor movement in both unorganized and organized shops, to build unions, to build struggles that, you know, convince their coworkers of their own strength, and also of the need to democratize unions, so we can wage battles not just for our own wages and working conditions, but over, you know, huge societal questions like what's happening in Gaza right now. Those, I think, debates were a huge advance. They do come with some question marks, or there are areas where we could use more clarity, for example, over electoral strategy, which we have already talked a lot about. Even though everyone affirms that we want a party of the working class, the questions of how we're going to get there are still a little vague. You know, what's the timeline for a break with the Democrats? Which are the social forces that are going to join us? Over what kind of program? How are we going to link the Zoran experience in New York City to RPA, to union struggles in California? These sorts of questions where the devil's in the details. But already it represents a huge advance on what we had before. And then the last thing would be Palestine, the last major programmatic debate. And I will say that, you know, just in the spirit of self-criticism, I wish that my tendency and other currents could work together to polarize the debate in a different way, around more outward-facing strategies for Palestinian liberation and practical tactics that we can use to advance the struggle. Actually, to that effect, one important resolution was adopted, the Labor for an Arms Embargo one. We have a very vibrant and dynamic DSA Labor Committee that is, you know, serving its members, trying to get all its members and labor unions involved to push their unions, you know, to not transfer arms to Israel, you know, to critique and organize ever more people around the U.S.'s continued, you know, legal, financial, militaristic cover and enabling of genocide by Israel. So that was one important kind of campaign that we affirmed. But in terms of that other part of the debate block, is very much concentrated on kind of like clarifying where DSA stands internally, you know, over expulsion measures, what constitutes, you know, a red line in that sense. I think just to contextualize some of those debates, DSA used to have a bigger, you know, kind of left Zionist block, no longer exists today, which is a great thing that we very much welcome. And, you know, the questions of discipline are not unimportant, given that, you know, I just mentioned people like AOC have taken indefensible votes. There have been controversies, especially around our bench of elected officials. And these are real questions that we need real positions on. I totally agree that we want more collectively oriented officials that are taking leadership from DSA, and that will hold the line on Palestine. But in terms of how to build that kind of bench, I think we have disagreements over that, whether it's going to come through drawing red lines in the sand and expulsion measures, or building a kind of organization that can, you know, potentially try to move these people and convince them through more collective, you know, coordination and struggles that, you know, put some wind at their backs instead of them feeling like, you know, they have to capitulate in the face of pressure. I think my aspirations for what kind of organization and what kind of elected officials we want to have are completely with them. I might critique this or that means. And overall, I would have liked to see the debate be more outward facing. But I think it was a very pressing kind of debate to be had, especially given the moment in the world that we're living through, where, you know, the genocide escalates to new unconscionable proportions every day. So, yeah, a lot more work to be done on that front. And, you know, the debate also didn't reflect all the kind of vibrant work DSA members have been doing. You know, I kind of come out of the student wing of that, where just next to me we saw encampments sweep the country, and I think one of the most dynamic and inspirational encampments happened close to me at SFSU, where they had, you know, open collective bargaining with the student movement against the administration, and it politicized a lot of people in really beautiful ways. So I'll leave it there.
You've actually, I guess, in part covered it, but I actually wanted to ask if you had any further comments about the way the DSA relates to broader campaigns. I guess I'm especially thinking the Palestine Solidarity campaign and the trade union movement, but also other campaigns as well. Like, how do you see your role as, you know, participating in these sort of broader campaigns?
Yeah, I think at a general level, the name of the game is socialists should jump into the mix, helping broaden these struggles as much as possible. We want everyone on our team that we can find, anybody who's willing to stand up against the far right, you know, we're welcoming progressive Democrats or liberals into the fold. I think that's very necessary at the moment if you have, you know, an accurate assessment of the balance of power in society where, you know, a small Marxist left is not able to face up to the challenges of the day. So, yeah, I think the name of the game is, you know, being in all the struggles that reflect all the diversity of the working class and the attacks that they're facing, helping them grow, but not just grow on any basis, but a strong programmatic basis. That doesn't mean we have to subordinate all these movements to socialist or DSA control, far from it. I think what we do want to do, though, is to argue that in order for these movements to be successful, they have to be democratic. They have to welcome people from all different walks of life who have different levels of experience in democratic organization and in politics to create a huge surface area for all of them to get involved, to contribute their own ideas about how to expand these movements. You know, for example, just to put some meat on the bones, a lot of people's experience with resistance to Trump is just going to a mobilization, holding a sign on the street, and then they go home, and then maybe they do it the next month, but there are very few opportunities to, you know, develop their ideas for them to contribute what they think the movement should do to win over more of their neighbors, more of their coworkers, to do other creative tactics, you know. And so we got to create this kind of surface area, and arguing not just for democracy, but for a class struggle orientation, you know, especially in a moment when we know that the rise of the far right has been undergirded by absolute democratic, you know, negligence is not the right word. This is exactly, you know, what they were hoping for: austerity, the absolute immiseration of the working class that the Democrats too have contributed to the problem. I'm not gonna, you know, we're not gonna condemn anybody who identifies as a Democrat, definitely not. But we do want to argue for a strategy that's founded on working people's ability to solve their problems together by themselves, not dependent on capitalist institutions, NGOs, the whole constellation of, you know, organizations that are under or subordinate to the leadership of the Democrats who got us into this mess in the first place. So, yeah, I think that's the broad kind of idea. Grow these movements, help them develop the politics necessary to be successful, but in a non-sectarian way. And through these movements, hopefully meet people that we can move to a strategic, you know, socialist horizon. You know, the hope that I have for DSA is the same aspiration that lit me up in the first place, that inspired other people in the first place. That's for DSA to raise the banner for all sorts of every single working class struggle, for the working class in all its diversity, and also hopefully to be one of the nuclei or a very important part of a future workers' party. It's clear that DSA needs to build broad alliances, but we also have some really special and important strategic ideas to contribute as, like, you know, one of the few or perhaps the only real mass democratic organization on the left in American society, where there's a real rich exchange of ideas and people who are thinking deeply about, you know, the crisis that we're living through and what it's going to take to get out of them. And so I think DSA, hopefully in that kind of broader coalition, will play a real important political kind of moral grounding role.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. I think that's sort of covered all the things I was going to ask about. Is there anything else that you want to say before we finish up?
Oh, no, just thanks so much. I mean, this experience has been really rich, and I mean, yeah, this is one of the bricks that we got to lay in the wall of building an international working class movement. And so this whole experience, the conference, this exchange here has been really, really beneficial, and we're excited to build more from it.
All right, fantastic. So much. Well, thank you very much for your time. Thanks very much for visiting Australia.
Cheers.
Thanks, everybody.
All right, so you were just listening to an interview with Sing Hong, who was talking about fighting for socialism in the United States. If our listeners enjoyed that interview, you can actually go watch the video of it on the Green Left website by going on greenleft.org.au. Now, before we go into our second live interview for the program, I was going to go play a song, which was going to be Baker Boy, In Control. And so I hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
got this. Yeah. No time for no wine, just a little out of line. Grind a bit beyond the right thing. Having positive mind frame. Group a nearly dream. Go on, Ailey, march you up. Did my echo need to thinking and be now Ulane. It's not about fame. Kicking goals, opening doors to a new era. Making sure it's correct. Not an error, otherwise you will disconnect. And the darkest days won't last forever. Even brighter days come sooner or later. Yako win, thinking much about what you're not. Billy need no more worry. Bunga world, gotta do what you gotta do. It's up to you where you wanna head. You're gonna have to break through. They turning up the pressure till it breaks you. So break through, come on.
They come, they go, but this I know. I will not let them hold me back, no. I shoot, I score, I give my all, my future. I am in control.
Yeah, yeah.
I am in control.
Yeah, yeah.
No
matter young and old, having dreams and goals, taking control on the fundamental role, negative roles. The ball running for the future got me feeling like a preacher. Uh-huh. There's nothing that you can't achieve when you're a seeker. Say what? Keep on moving straight ahead and be your icon like a pillar for the next gen. Okay, okay.
They come, they go, but this I know I will not let them hold me back no more. I shoot, I score, I give my all, my future. I am in control.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM, and you're just listening to In Control by Baker Boy. Okay, so we're now joined for our first live interview for the program by Fred Fuentes, who is a regular Green Left writer on Venezuela and has also been a long-time solidarity activist with Latin America. Specifically, Fred has done a lot of writing on the experience of left governments in Latin America, specifically focusing on Venezuela and Bolivia. So we have Fred on the program to kind of talk about the kind of massive military buildup in the Caribbean Sea, which is targeting Latin America. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on this excellent program. Always important to be able to hear and talk about such important issues.
Yeah, awesome, Fred, to have you on air. What can you tell us about the US military deployment in Latin America and specifically around the Caribbean Sea?
Yeah, so look, I think the first thing to say is that this deployment, you know, must be opposed, you know, because of the real dangers that it poses to really all of the countries in the region. In terms of the specifics of it, what we know is that essentially since mid-August, the US has been deploying various warships into the Caribbean region. Now, there's been a bit of conflicting information about exactly how many warships have been deployed and exactly where they are in the region. But we're sort of, you know, if we add up all the information together, we're talking about the possibility that there's something like 8 different warships, a nuclear submarine, some 1,200 missiles, and possibly up to about 6,000 U.S. Marines, all sort of in the Caribbean region. So as you can see, this is a quite a large military buildup. that's being deployed in the area, and which poses real threats in a number of different ways.
And what can you tell us about the aim of the deployment, and what does it kind of reflect in terms of the broader foreign policy trends by the Trump administration within the United States?
Yeah, so if we listen to the US officials, I think we could separate out what are potentially two different sort of aims that they've at least publicly stated. The first and the one that they emphasise the most is that this has to do with fighting what they refer to as narco-terrorism. Now, the context there is that earlier this year, the Trump administration basically labelled a whole bunch of drug cartels as terrorist organisations, which obviously mean that they can then be dealt with in quite a different manner than from what a normal criminal organisation would be able to be dealt with under their legislation. So that's the official guise that they're deploying it on to fight these drug cartels operating in Latin America and supposedly flooding the US with drugs. Now, within that, we also have to include the fact that the US has very specifically targeted the Venezuelan government in this context. It has labelled President Nicolas Maduro as the head of a drug cartel, in particular referring to the Cartel of the Suns, a cartel which, it should be noted, even US intelligence reports have questioned whether it even exists, let alone whether it has any connections to the Venezuelan government. And the Trump administration also, only a few months ago, increased the bounty on information leading to Maduro's capture to something in the vicinity of $50 million. So obviously there's the general sort of issue of fighting drugs, and then there's the very specific targeting here of the Venezuelan government, which the US government has directly tied and said is involved in drug trafficking. Having said that, that's on the public level of what the US administration is talking about. But I think if we want to go a bit deeper, what we really have to understand about this deployment is that really what the US government is seeking to do here really is change the whole rules of the game. Now, of course, it's been trying to do this at an international level, but it's now playing out in its own region. And I think here fundamentally what it's seeking to do is firstly established the idea that itself, the US, is the big power in the region and is the one that can decide what happens. So it's thrown out any attempts of multilateralism. It hasn't even bothered doing as what it would normally have done in the past few years of trying to convene gatherings of the Organization of American States to get up votes in that body with its compliant governments in the region supporting its aims. And it's just setting out, look, this is our aim, and we're going to do it, irrespective of what anyone else thinks about this, irrespective of any of the previous rules of the international rules-based order. And secondly, it's showing that it's willing to not just do this in a symbolic fashion, but to do this very concretely. And we've seen that through the military strikes on at least three, potentially four boats in the region. Really actions that can only be described as extrajudicial executions with no attempt to board the ships, to find out who's on the ships, what's on the ships, investigate what's happening. So really a very dangerous precedent that breaks all kinds of international laws and even US protocols for dealing with drug trafficking and drug boats. So we're seeing very dangerous precedents being set here. We're seeing a reshaping of US foreign policy, and all of this is being carried out supposedly under the guise of fighting narco-terrorism, of which the Venezuelan government has been linked into. So a dangerous situation which, as I said, really has to be opposed.
So, Fred, what can you tell us about the kind of response from different sort of Latin American governments to this US military deployment? Have they kind of condemned what the US is doing? What kind of resistance are they giving to the US's kind of aggressive posture?
Yes, so quite a number of the governments have been quite outspoken in opposing this, of course, because they understand the dangers of it. Two, perhaps, of the most outspoken countries, unsurprising, because they have, in many ways also being targeted as part of this deployment, are the governments of Colombia and Mexico, both of which have progressive sort of centre-left governments in power. Now, why I say they're also targets of this deployment is the fact that, you know, again, only a few months before this deployment, the U.S. administration was very clearly talking about the fact that they were preparing or at least planning for the possibilities of land strikes on targets that they deemed to be part of, you know, as I referred to before, narco-terrorism. So they've openly talked about that. And in fact, only just last week, the Washington Post, basically released papers that, you know, again, were an open secret, but now were confirmed, where the Pentagon had prepared and offered up plans to the government of where they of how and where they believed such strikes could be carried out on Mexican soil against, again, so-called narco-terrorist criminal gangs. So they've been particularly outspoken. Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, has sought to try to call an emergency meeting of the governments, or at least of the foreign ministers of the governments in the region to discuss a unified plan. But I think so far that's been perhaps the biggest problem, that most of these governments, while being very clearly outspoken and not afraid to sort of confront the U.S. government, and that's led to retaliatory action. So we've seen that in the case of Colombia, where the U.S. government has, as a result of Petro's brave stance, what it calls decertified Colombia. And that is saying that taking Colombia off the list of countries that are supposedly cooperating with the fight against narco trafficking as a first step towards sort of punishing Colombia. These governments have been outspoken, but as yet haven't been able to really get a united response. And that's really what's necessary at this point in time. Like in the face of such a dangerous and such a big operation that the U.S. is carrying out against the whole region, what's really needed is a regional response. And as yet, you know, that's maybe in train, but it's certainly not there yet, and really should have been there a lot quicker, given that we're talking about, as I said, a military deployment that began in mid-August and which really can be dated back, you know, to the beginning of this year with Trump officials openly talking about this possibility.
Fred, it's Mary. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Mary.
It just blows my mind that this is just such a clear example of the US acting like a rogue state, just assassinating people without any evidence or, you know, following, as some of our politicians also always talk about, the rule of law, which would mean you arrest those people first before you would just assassinate them. So it's just... it's mind-blowing that the US can get away with this. What do you think should be the response of people in Australia and maybe even our politicians?
Yeah, look, I think you're right, because in terms of the rogue state element, because, look, let's be honest, it's not like the US hasn't done, you know, stuff like this before. But I think what enters us into new and dangerous waters is that, you know, previously, you know, things like attacks on these boats would be kept quiet or denied, and generally it would only be until whistleblowers sort of released videos of such sort of crimes carried out by the US government that they would be forced to respond. But here it's quite the opposite. Here they're the ones openly posting the videos and openly boasting about the fact that, you know, they could have intercepted the boat and investigated, but they consciously chose to, as I said, extrajudicially execute these people. Mm. So it's very much a rogue state that has assumed its role as a rogue state and openly proclaims that and is proud and boastful of that fact. So I think that puts us in a position where we definitely here in Australia need to be calling on the Australian government to call these actions out. I mean, you know, Albanese, on the one hand, he'll talk tough about Trump and disagree with some of Trump's policies, and then, you know, the next week he'll be grovelling back to the US, sort of saying, well, sure, we might have some differences, but, you know, we can all work together. Well, I think this is one of those times where, you know, very clearly the Australian government has to come out and say, look, just even at the level of basically accepting international law, you know, this is clearly wrong, clearly must be opposed, and clearly it's time for governments to speak out on that. So I think we should be seeking to get the Albanese government to say something, which, it has to be said, up until this point has said nothing on this particular issue. So it is beholden on us, because, as I said, the dangerous situation, I think we are certainly in a position where we're creeping closer and closer to where the US actually start doing land strikes under the same guise. I'm not saying that's definitely going to happen, but you know the problem is that Trump's going to have to be able to sell something out of this whole deployment. You know, it's not enough to just do symbolism. He's going to be able to prove that this whole military deployment has worked. And I think one of those avenues he has is to see whether he can get away with a land strike. Because as I said, at this point in time, it's not clear whether beyond sort of the declarations of opposition, there'll be much more opposition towards it. Were the US government to carry out such strike, whether that's in Venezuela, Colombia, Mexico, or anywhere. In fact, even if we look at the boats that have been hit, only really now and just recently in the last few days, Colombian President Gustavo Petro at the United Nations was the one that said, look, actually, these things have to be investigated and people, brought to justice under international law, because these are illegal actions. These are just daylight executions being carried out that contravene all sorts of different laws, and people have to be held responsible for these. So, you know, that's a good start, and that's the kind of sort of position that the Australian government should also be taking.
Yeah. But he's also attacking his own people within the USA with those ICE agents killing people with, not following the rule of law. So this is a rogue state internally and externally.
Absolutely. And look, and the two can't be separated out. The two can't be separated because really, what we're seeing is both a militarisation abroad along with a militarisation at home. But the other reason we can't separate out is that the US government has very much in its discourse talked about the idea, and here Venezuela is the prime target. It's not the exclusive, but the Venezuelan government is a prime target of sort of saying that these governments and these narco-terrorist drug cartels are responsible for the disturbances and the troubles we have at home. So we see that direct link that's been made between the two by the government, and you can not rule out the possibility that, on the one hand, the strikes are carried out elsewhere to argue that this is necessary to protect, the situation at home, but that also this whole, sort of crisis situation, basically, sort of semi-warlike situation in the Caribbean isn't also used to further justify crackdowns within the US on the basis that, we're having to deal with the internal sort of fallout of these narco-terrorist organisations who have infiltrated into the US and are causing all sorts of problems for us. So there's a very direct link there as well.
Yep.
All right. Thanks a lot for this interview, Fred. Do you have any final comments you want to end on?
Yeah, look, the only thing I could say is just once again, I really want to emphasise that this is a very dangerous situation, not just because of what it might mean in the immediate term, in terms of, will there be more boats struck by missiles? Will, as I said, will there possibility be there of land strikes? And we can't even rule that it could go further. I think at this point in time, the idea of a full-scale invasion of any country is sort of seems remote, but remote doesn't mean impossible. So all these things are at play. And as I said, they fit into a broader framework of how the Trump government is trying to reshape world politics, try to reshape basically get rid of the whole international rules-based order, which, of course, we could have a big, long interview and discussion about its weaknesses. But in the face of that, replacing it with a might wins out kind of great powers sort of politics is certainly not the world that we want to head into. So I think in that regard, being able to, as I said, the broadest possible response we can do, involving all the different Latin American governments that are speaking out, involving all of the different left groups, trade unions, who all of them have very different positions in regards to how they view the governments of Venezuela, of Colombia, of Mexico. Some are more supportive, some are more critical. But really, this is the time where, whilst we can maintain those differences, for us to be able to seek those points of unity to see if we can successfully push back this military deployment and make the Trump administration pay for this, rather than allow them to get away with setting a dangerous precedent for the world we're heading into.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Fred. And just to inform listeners as well, Fred actually has some interviews available on Green Left that you can kind of read about this kind of particular topic. Thanks again, Fred. And I think this has been a very informative and very important kind of discussion.
Oh, once again, thanks for the opportunity to be able to speak on your excellent program.
Bye, Fred.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. So we were just speaking to Fred Fuentes, Green Left writer and also longtime Latin American solidarity activist, about Trump's the Trump administration's military deployment in Latin America. So I thought actually before we go into the activist calendar, maybe we'll have a bit of a song. So this is the next song that was sort of put down on the put down to play. We're going to play "The King Is Dead" by The Herd.
Yay.
You're listening to Green Left Radio.
Oh. We dance like New Year's Eve. We dance from sheer relief. Everything must change.
The people that you projected aside were nothing of the sort. Sold us all short, put down a champagne. No toast to the legacy. And all the propaganda of prosperity. That's what a machine does, and they don't need therapy. You turn us into a nation of haters. Fire right at Pisa, believing whatever kept your leader. Dog whistle through the speakers, see who bites it. Notice the hell of a lot of people liked it. An ethical choice is simpler if you price it. Conquer by dividing, that's where you admired him. Unless pushed, we would never have retired him. Fucking pirate. History will damn him. Once it seemed like nothing could damage him.
Sasha Liu Chi, the way Shao Tung.
Crook, you got your eyes played in Mandarin.
Finally, the king is dead. They cried off with his head. Everything must change.
Everything must change.
We dance like New Year's Eve. We dance from relief. Everything must change.
Nothing stays the same.
Yeah. I know we're feeling this like the rapture. And I can tell who this mood is failing to capture. It's like somebody finally did light that match up and burn down the parliament. Learn from the argument, can't be nonpartisan. When you're an artisan, you put your heart in it. That's not even a half of it. Like my man said, we're talking butter and bread. Better if his words were never uttered again. Mostly vindictive, who could have predicted? Just a few tax breaks to keep us all addicted. The dickhead, dictator, leader, imitator. Made me feel immature when I said I hate ya. Did you read the paper the day after I hear the laughter? I'll read it to you. It starts with M and Q and ends with you. No broader view for the people on your ship who you used to call crew. That's typical. Now I guess it's difficult for the type of person only thinks of individual. No residual. You'll see our resilience. Take your bat and ball ahead for the pavilion.
Finally the king is dead. They cried off with his head. Everything must change.
From sheer relief, oh, everything must change.
Just promise me this, no rose petal glasses, quickly consigning to part of the past. Just promise me this, no rose petal glasses, quickly consigning to part of the past.
All right, you're just listening to "The King Is Dead" by The Herd. So now it is time for the Green Left Activist Calendar. So we have a number of events coming up. So on Friday, September the 26th, today, there's going to be a rally, Unite Against Racism, at 2 p.m. at the State Library in Swanson Street in the city. Then on Sunday, the 28th of September, there'll be a lecture, Understanding Palestine, with Yusuf Omawawi. That's going to be happening at 4:30 p.m. at the Black Spark Cultural Centre, 26A Gladstone Avenue in Northcote. And then on Wednesday, October the 1st, there'll be a Rising Tide National Online Blockade Information Session. On Saturday, October the 4th, there'll be a rally, Big Action for Threatened Species, and that will be happening at 2 p.m. at Treasury Gardens. And then I think Mary had an event she wants to announce.
Well, it's just the same date, the 4th of October. I did mention it earlier.
Yep.
But just want to remind people again, the rally in Eltham for Palestine, the Nilambic local Palestine group and the Menzies local Palestine group have worked together on this. It starts at 11:30 in the Eltham Town Square, which is just off Arthur Street, just behind the shops. So please come along and support us.
Yep. And then on Sunday, October the 12th, I forgot to mention, actually, there will be weekly Palestine rallies at 12 p.m. on Sunday. So on basically both on the 28th of September and the 5th of October. But more importantly, there is going to be a nationwide march for Palestine on Sunday, October the 12th. And now that is going to probably be one of the more important rallies that's going to be coming up, because it's going to be a big, massive kind of national day of action. And it's very much being built as the next big protest for Palestine. So, yeah, I think this is going to be the protest that I think you should tell your friends and family about getting along to, talk to your workmates. I think we really want to make it to into a huge protest, similar to the previous National Day of Action that happened. All right, so I might just go play a quick few announcements and then we'll go on to the next news discussion. You're listening to Green Left Radio, and just for listeners' information, you can find out more information about all the events that we spoke about on greenleft.org.au/events.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM, and I'm going to go pass it on to Mary and Steph to start off this important news discussion.
Yeah, so while the grand final weekend and today holiday, and I support any excuse for a holiday, I think that's justified because we all work so hard, so we deserve as many holidays as possible. But for many people, this weekend is going to be a dangerous weekend because the rates of domestic violence increase and the police are usually on alert or to be prepared for call-outs because sadly domestic violence just increases over this weekend.
Yeah, that's right, Mary. And I guess, you know, there's... And, you know, in saying this, I am really biased. I'm not somebody who follows football. And I know there might be listeners out there who do, and football's important to them. And, you know, totally respect that, and that's fine. And at the same time, I think it's really important that it's not just a grand final either. It's pretty much all major events, including sporting events, there's an increase in family violence. And, like, alcohol plays a big part, but we just need to be really clear on this as well, that alcohol, and I'm sure this isn't news to any of our listeners, but alcohol does not cause family violence. Family violence is a choice. However, alcohol does increase the risk. And alcohol and any sort of substance use, it's problematic. So
it just makes it easier for some people to engage in that kind of behaviour, because it sort of lowers perhaps their thresholds.
Yeah.
And their inhibitions. Yeah. That's, yeah.
But, yeah, still.
But it's still no excuse. Yeah.
No, absolutely not. And so, yeah, and if, as well as police preparing, which, you know, I mean, that's a whole topic as well, just how helpful and really unhelpful most of the time that police interventions are for family violence. But of course, yeah, the crisis lines like 1-800 Respect and Safe Steps tend to experience a massive surge in demand. And I guess, like, in the context as well, I mean, other risk factors that really can contribute, like, include things like unemployment and like the cost of living crisis and conflict. And at the moment, we as a society are experiencing immense economic pressure on the working class families. And yeah, that does increase the risk of family violence.
And apparently, yeah. Some of the research shows that gambling adds to the whole mix, because if you gamble on teams winning or losing, you lose, then that can increase your financial stress and increase your anger, and you take it out on the people close to you.
Just to add some stats actually around this, so I'm referring to an article from Pedestrian that speaks to this exact issue around the grand final weekend and AFL specifically, and family violence, and I would just say gender-based violence in general, because as many people are aware, culture around AFL clubs and, yeah, just AFL in general is really problematic. Like, there's so many, there's so much misogyny, there's rape culture, it's horrendous.
Well, the fact that the AFL has invited Snoop Dogg out, a person who is responsible for misogynistic, violent and comments about using violence against women. But also homophobic comments, underscores what you just said.
Yeah, it speaks volumes to, yeah, just how toxic a culture it is. And I guess it's interesting too, like, having seen the rise of the AFLW too. And, I mean, if I was ever going, I have actually seen a football game before, which is a weird thing to say, but I have. But I guess, like, as well, like, the misogyny is just so entrenched. It's not, and I guess that's what allows and really exacerbates family violence. Because as we know, the biggest risk factor for family violence is gender inequality. And it is rife through AFL and through sporting in general, where currently AFL women's team, they still earn about, I just read, 22.5% on average less than their male counterparts. However, that's an average, so I'm sure there'd be cases where it's a lot larger. So, I'm not sure if that's a mean or a median average, but, yeah, I'd be interested to know about that and just how big an impact the outliers might have on that calculation. Yeah. But yeah.
I remember my first football match that I went to, this is many, many years ago, and I was standing amongst other fans, and all you could hear was, "Hit him in the balls! Kick him!" And, you know, and the guy standing around with beer cans. It was just the most unappealing situation to be in. I have been to other matches which didn't sound so bad, but that, was not pleasant, and it just sort of was an example of some fans.
Yeah. I guess I want to kind of add to this kind of discussion. I mean, there's a few things also as well. I mean, the first thing I think as well, it's not just about the AFL necessarily. It's about actually all major sporting events. So if you look at in other parts of the world, whenever the Super Bowl is on in the United States, whenever there's a big football match like the World Cup, for example, there's a consistently kind of reported trend that domestic violence always goes up around those particular times. I mean, I think, you know, people all have a right here to point out to the kind of masculinity that kind of these sporting kind of institutions sort of promote.
Yeah.
And I think, I guess one thing I'll probably note about going back to the specific example of the AFL is there is actually a lot of some pressure being applied on the AFL. Like, the reality is, the AFL as an institution could actually be doing a lot more actually, you know, criticise quite openly this kind of macho kind of culture that promotes kind of this kind of violence.
Yeah.
Gambling. The gambling industry is a whole other issue in itself, but I mean the government actually has a lot of responsibility for that because the government has refused to kind of take any serious action around gambling. In fact, it was reported, I think it was reported like months ago that one of the reasons that they didn't want to take any action against the gambling industry was that they were concerned that it would actually kill the entire broadcast, commercial broadcasting, as in...
Because they're funded by the gambling industry.
Well, yeah, pretty much a lot of their money comes out of advertising for gambling.
Yeah.
And the local hotels, pubs, rely on poker machines and so forth.
Yeah, and the state government itself is also benefits hugely from pokie machines, and they'll pressure local councils and local communities to pokies. And you've got to fight pretty hard if you don't want that.
So I guess that was just what I was saying before. Yeah. I think there's a lot of more pressure. There is a lot of pressure on the AFL to do more. Similarly, there has been also pressure on the AFL to actually take more seriously issues like Indigenous rights, for example, which the AFL has responded to over the years.
And sometimes dragging its feet.
And then also the other issue is obviously the treatment of queer people within their AFL, and of course, and also probably one thing I would also add as well is one of the biggest problems of that the AFL is the kind of tight leash that they also put on their players from speaking up about issues. In fact, you probably notice that, you know, there's not many prominent AFL players that are speaking up right now for Palestine or Gaza. Mm. But in fact, there was actually one AFL player, I think he was from the Fremantle Dockers recently, who clearly indicated his sort of allegiance, his sort of sympathies with Palestine, because he had liked an Instagram status by the pro-Palestine hip-hop group Kneecap. And as soon as he liked that status, suddenly there was all this controversy about how, the AFL needs to take action against this problem of anti-Semitism. So, you know, there's actually a lot of barriers on like AFL players themselves from even just speaking up about any kind of political matter, whether it is First Nations rights, against the genocide in Gaza. It's just a real, one of the big problems as well is the fact that the AFL is very much one of the most prominent sort of capitalist sort of institutions. It is probably one of the most commercialized sports leagues in the world, and it's to the point where there are whole teams that are just created, like Greater Western Sydney.
Look at their demands on Tasmania.
Yeah.
That they have to build this stadium, and it has to be built to a certain in a certain style, which is going to cost Tasmanians millions, and it doesn't matter what Tasmanians think or want.
Yeah,
it's just outrageous.
I mean, Tasmania already has a football stadium. That's what makes the story so ridiculous. But it's all about expanding the market for AFL, because the construction of the stadium is tied to the creation of a future Tasmanian AFL team.
So I guess, like, I might just for listeners actually who do need support, because family violence is rife. It's one in three women, And the women who are most at risk are young women aged 18 to 25. And so, and I know there's young people listening. I know there's probably people listening who are even experiencing family violence now. So I just want to put this out there that you're not alone, and it's okay to seek help whenever you feel ready. It can be really hard to leave an abusive relationship. And I work as a counsellor helping people recover from family violence, and it has a massive toll on people. But there is, you know, support available if anyone listening does need to leave or needs help in any way managing a violent relationship. So I'm just going to plug 1-800-RESPECT. The phone number is 1-800-737-732. So if anyone's needing support around that, to please reach out.
That's good. Yep.
So just to maybe go into another news story. This is just taken from the pages of Green Left, but you can read a bit on this article on in the international section. But basically, it's just a report that the Telstra strike, the Tesla strike is still going strong after 650 days. Yeah. So industrial
in Sweden,
and in fact, industrial action, it's been reported here, actually began only as early as late October 2023, sorry, after the company refused to sign a collective agreement with the union representing workers. So for Tesla's behaviour, it's been reported that it's driven by the CEO, well, you know, Elon Musk, refusal to acknowledge unions or engage in collective bargaining on principle. It's been kind of reported that the National Mediation Institute Director General Irene Wenamu has concluded that the mediation sessions between Tesla and IF Metal on September 3rd and reported on the progress or lack of therefore that has achieved since it began in October 2023. Mm. And probably some of the big sort of issues that the union is sort of raising is they very much want annual pay increases to be aligned with market rates. They want reduced working hours comparable to those at other car repair shops and pension solutions on par with industry kind of standards. Yeah. I guess all the kind of solidarity to the Tesla workers in Sweden. I mean, I think it's quite incredible that the strike has been going on for after 650 days. In fact, the strike actually in some ways has been going on for as long as the Palestine Solidarity Movement has been going in terms of the kind of consistent sort of regular kind of protests.
And I can imagine that the workers just got to a point where they said enough is enough, because I read that the burnout rate is just enormous and people are suffering all sorts of mental health but also physical health consequences of burnout because the speed ups have occurred.
Yeah.
And so they're working harder and longer than what they started when the company was first first went to Sweden. So I think that's the underlying thing. Definitely the pay, of course, but also this, you know, the way that people are expected to work, and that would drive people to strike and to keep on striking if they know that they're just going to go back to the same conditions if they were to stop their strike.
Yeah, it's horrendous, and just the overtime that they're being forced to work. And just a real quick check on Google. Tesla's market, the company value as of September, is about $1.43 trillion. And this is just Tesla. That's not even the other companies that Elon Musk owns. So I just want to point that out. They can afford to give these workers what they're worth.
But his sales have dropped a little bit, Stephanie.
Oh,
and
no.
So he needs to make the workers pay for it.
Money. Yeah, okay. No, absolutely not. Pay your workers and stop being a Grinch.
Yeah.
Elon Musk.
Okay. All right, so we're getting to the end of our program. So I guess I'd like to kind of thank all our listeners for tuning in this week. I just also want to make a bit of a plug. If you enjoy our program and enjoy the kind of news and analysis that 3CR Community Radio and Green Left Radio presents to you on a daily basis, I mean, we highly encourage you to become a supporter of Green Left. You can become a supporter of Green Left by going on greenleft.org.au/support. And becoming a financial supporter of Green Left only costs up to $5 or $10 a month, so you can kind of sign up there. We also like to really give a plug to 3CR and becoming a 3CR subscriber. I mean, 3CR, like Green Left, you know, very much relies generously on the financial contributions of ordinary listeners like you to keep us on the air. And yeah, you can become a subscriber by going on to 3cr.org.au and just go on to the subscribe section of the website. But yeah, any other final words that Mary and Steph would like to add?
Just have a lovely holiday and goodbye.
Yeah, and yeah, thanks to all the guests that joined our show, and thank you everyone for listening. Thank you.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1800 634 206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses,
arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back, reds underneath your beds and that crack.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.